is the 15th of December, 1998, and I'm with Jochen Buch at his conference room in the basement of Cornell University Medical College. And I wanted to start off today with some questions from yesterday and then basically pick up where we left off in your decisions to go to medical school and not become an organizer for pacifism and anti-nuclear interests in Germany. And so my first question, I guess, is was there any pressure for you to become a butcher?
No, definitely not.
Okay. Well, before I get back to that, because you had to remind me to ask you a question, but I'll get to that in just a minute. What kind of religious traditions were you brought up with?
I was brought up with the religion of our village and of my parents, and this is Protestantism with this typical Swabian Württembergish background, which is a mix out of Lutheranism and Calvinism, wildly mixed.
Yeah, is this, would this be in the Pietismus kind of tradition?
In all the Swabian villages, the church has two fractions. It has the Pietistic fraction and the non-so-Pietistic fraction. And clear-cut, my parents are not Pietists, and I never could identify with them anyway.
Were there some in the village that you lived in?
Pietists? Oh, yes. Okay. Oh, sure. Look, in each of the villages in Swabia, you have the so-called Stundenhaus. This is, the Pietists have additionally to going normally to church, they have their special meeting place where they meet once or twice additionally per week.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And with this kind of Lutheranism, Calvinism, what kind of things did you do? Like, did you go to church on Sunday? Did your activities revolve around Sunday school? Did you have the rituals like the Holy Communion and the Confirmation? And
okay. What
kind of practices?
So baptism is immediately after birth in the first weeks. And then for children, it starts with children's church, Sunday school. This is after the regular church, there is 1 hour for children where they tell them stories and where they sing, where we sing, yeah.
And did you go to those? Did you and your brother have to?
Once every month.
Okay.
Whenever.
Okay.
And I think we enjoyed it. And then there is, I think at the age of 14, confirmation. Mm-hmm. Do you have that here?
Mm-hmm.
And also you had education before that.
Mm-hmm.
And this was now that I had an education, not at the gymnasium, which was at the next city. I went to school not in Neuhausen but in Metzingen, which was the next city which had a gymnasium. And but my education for confirmation I had now in Neuhausen, and this was really a new experience because I met the people again with which I went to elementary school, and it was interesting the different experiences we had. And it also, look, I was now 13, and I remember fighting with the priest about stuff he wanted to teach us. Like, he was, one thing I remember, yeah, me as a 13-year-old, you know, he was totally against relationships between boys and girls.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that I was fighting with him during that time as a 13, 14-year-old, but nothing would speak against it if we would kiss. However, sex, you know, no way. It was really fun, and thinking back. But after confirmation, Now, if you ask me whether I'm religious, and I would say no, I'm not. However, I still like the tradition of the church as it's there, because the church is more than religion. It's also a place which, one typical example is, the church is a place for old people, where old people can meet, let's say, once a week, and can have coffee together. And look, it has social functions in the Swabian villages, mm-hmm. which for many different age groups, essentially. And it's not linked now to totally to what you normally think as religion, you know? Then what else do I like with the church? Look, I see that it gives somebody like my grandmother, it gave, in a way it helped her, you know? Or by giving simply a tradition you could live with. And in this context, I really have absolutely nothing against the church as I experienced it. However, if you ask me, do you believe in Jesus Christ and all the dogmas, yeah. I would tell you no. Yeah. Yeah.
And how about kind of a central deity of any kind?
Whether I believe in that?
Yeah.
I'm not sure. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure. The thing is, I have a very strong gut feeling that life is okay. And also that my life is okay. Does that have anything to do with a deity? Perhaps. I do not know.
No. Okay.
I do not know.
Okay. And what kind of tradition?
Wait.
Okay.
Do I believe in a personal God?
Okay.
Who has to tell me anything as me as a person? No, I doubt that. But I, on the other side, I like out of the religion I grew up with that the main values they have are values which I can accept for myself.
Okay. And then what kind of traditions are you bringing forward to your own children?
You know, this is a not yet solved problem. The reason for it is because I do not believe in these biblical stories, but they are nice stories. And what's happening is that Hannes, he's now 5 years old, is starting to ask questions. Mm-hmm. And I really have to come here to grips with my wife, Chantal, that we decide what we want to do and what we do not want to do. And it will be interesting because Friederike, she's our 2-year-old daughter, will go next year to a pre-nursery school, which is by the church next door.
Oh, okay.
So let's see where it goes, you know.
Yeah. Okay.
How unusual was it, or typical was it, this decision you made to become a conscientious objector? And then to be granted a civil dienst at the time you went through this.
Okay. Out of my class at the gymnasium, very likely I was the only one who did it. And but it was not unusual. Thinking back at that time, but that's now a rough estimate, it could be that perhaps in general 1 out of 10 of the boys with a higher education and perhaps 1 out of 30 of the boys in general went for this option. Yeah.
So typically those who'd gone to the gymnasium would probably be more likely to ask for conscientious.
Essentially, two groups asked for it. Mm-hmm. The one was similar to my background, and the other group was were very religious people. Yeah.
Okay, and I wanted to ask you, how did you defend yourself at this trial? What grounds were you based on?
Essentially that it was on a humanistic background where I said, I cannot deal with consciously with decisions I would have to make if I would be a soldier. It was much less political as I would have done it years later. During that time, it was mostly that I said, I do not want to learn how to kill people. And I cannot do it. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. But it wasn't for religious, any kind of religious
argument? No, no, no. Okay. No, it simply was founded on that, on this notion, I do not want to learn to kill. And I cannot do it. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. And you had mentioned, to remind me to ask you, when you engaged in your activities, your nonviolent activities and very organized activities, you weren't, and you did blockade the military installation. Why did you not, although you were arrested, why didn't you receive any penalty?
Okay. Oh, that's a little bit now a mix-up.
Okay.
So how often was I arrested?
Okay.
I think I was arrested a total of 3 times. And the first 2 times, it did not come to an accusation because they simply wanted not to allow us to make the whole stuff public.
Right.
And they were then totally astonished when this whole movement became stronger.
Yeah.
And the next time when I was arrested, they must have lost the group of the people they arrested, must have been the people who were arrested in before us, the people who were arrested after us, where got their summons, and we never got them. So we do not know why we did not get it. Yeah. But then there was another situation, and this we will talk in shortly again. This was that the blockade, the big blockade, was 2 to 4 weeks before the major exam in medical school. And when I said that I would organize this blockade, I also said that I want to go through this test. And I said that now I participate during the actual blockade, during the first week, but the second week was so near to the exam that I essentially left the whole thing and started to study, and went on to full-time study for the exam. Yeah, that was the biggest exam in the medical school.
Yeah, okay. And
so I was not arrested during.
Okay, during. I see. Yeah. So one reason why you didn't get any penalties is because this was very early in this kind of activity across Germany, and they just didn't want to publicize the event.
Right, right, right.
Yeah. Okay, and we talked about this political activity, but you also were engaging in what I probably at the time would be considered alternative lifestyle and living in a commune.
Right.
And how did that kind of influence or change your views on what you wanted out of life?
You know, it was a time where this, in how many different, I lived in 3 different communes. And the first commune did not, was simply happening that people moved together who needed housing.
Right.
So without any other background, But when I moved in the second one, it was already clear that I wanted to move together with people who have similar ideas as I had and, during that time. And I was, but we did not, I was looking with the same people with which I, with whom I planned this, did this other nonviolent activities. We wanted to look for a house for ourselves. And we needed about, I think, 1.5 years. And then we bought an old farmhouse 10 kilometers out of Tübingen. That's the university town where we were. And we rebuilt it. And we started to try to develop a common future, and which never worked out.
And why do you think it? Why do you think
I was the only person on purpose during that time? I said I was the only one who moved in there who did not move in with his or her partner. And the interesting, I thought it would be too fragile to bring my relationship business into the commune. And what's really interesting, into the Wohngemeinschaft, and what's interesting is that it broke all due to relationships. So
yeah.
it did not break due to that ideas or that we could not had difficulties with each other on political or ideal level. No, the thing broke apart due to relationships. And by the way, it still exists.
Wow.
And two of the original founders still live there. And they started to adopt. No, not to adopt. How do you call it? If you take kids, you cannot adopt.
Foster.
They became
parents.
Foster parents, and I really should go by and check what they are doing.
Yeah. So this must have been a large farmhouse that you...
It was an old 350-year-old farmhouse, and essentially what we did was... Look, the old farmhouses in Germany are relatively small, and we were 9 people, and we wanted room to have for at least 12, 13, that sometimes people can sleep over and so on. And so what we did was that we, the part where the animals were originally, we rebuilt that.
And at what point did you get married in all of this the first time?
I got married the first time 2 weeks before I came to America.
Wow.
So the first marriage was, I was during at that time with Regina, and we had a long-term relationship, and she wanted to come with me to America and needed a visa.
Mm-hmm.
And this is why we married.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And why did I leave the commune?
Mm-hmm. Okay. Why did you leave the commune? And when did you leave the commune?
I left due to that, my girlfriend of that time essentially forced me out. She put me under pressure, either me or the Wohngemeinschaft. And what happened was I moved out and moved in with her, and the relationship broke after 4 months.
Oh.
So,
And why didn't you move back into the Wohngemeinschaft?
Into the old one?
Yeah.
Because why didn't I move back? You know, that's now in hindsight a tough question. Perhaps eventually because it was not time.
Yeah. But you moved into a third one then?
Out of the second, I immediately went into a third one,
okay.
Together with the woman who forced me.
Okay.
Yeah, so...
Okay. And then, I guess that kind of brings us up to where we left off yesterday, and that was I wanted to ask what specifically, again, just to kind of catch up to where we left off yesterday, what specifically about the your experience at the in your civil service job working with these physically and mentally disabled young men led you to medicine?
Okay. Essentially, it was a negative selection. As I told you, in the 2 years or a year before I went to civil service, I wanted to do mathematics.
Right.
And then after, during that time, suddenly it hit me that I, for me, it was clear that if I would do academic mathematics, this would mean that I would have very little contact with people.
Mm-hmm.
And I simply wanted to do something where I'm in direct contact with people, and this led to the decision to go into medicine, but also with the knowledge that medicine is extremely broad. And then later also I had this idea that I wanted to go into to become a family practitioner into general medicine, which was a big bubble. Because what happened was, so I started medical school, and I did my first two clerkships with people doing general medicine, family practitioners, and it was extremely boring. What happened was that during the first, when I really came in direct contact with what's done in general medicine I found it boring. And the other thing was that I also thought that the expectations did not fit, or what you study in medical school, what it's done the way it's mostly done in general medicine, what's expected by these doctors, that does not overlap. If you go to a general practice, as I experienced it, either people are not sick, or you have psychosomatic diseases where essentially the people have psychological problems, and it manifests itself in sometimes in somatic diseases, sometimes in nothing, you know. And I could not deal with that. Then what happened was that, so what really interested me, I did not like surgery at all. That seemed to be too bloody, and I never liked the hierarchy in with surgeons, which has to be, because somebody has to be in control, but it's not for me. So what was I attracted by? A little bit by internal medicine, because it seemed that the people in internal medicine are at least logical. And but attracted, I only was to pediatrics. And this also was due to an experience. When I was in medical school, I got some money from my parents, but otherwise I also made some money by working during the night in a hospital, doing nursing jobs. And it really was this was now perhaps in 77 or so. I spent my first nights at the Children's Hospital of the University of Tübingen. And these nights were important for me, because taking direct care of sick children, I liked it. I also liked there's a special climate in pediatric hospitals, which you do not find in other hospitals, more lively, more, and I enjoyed that. And then working, how much did I work? Perhaps 4 nights per month. This were about 400 marks, so this is what I needed. And then, after perhaps the first half year, or so I worked with normal intensive care kids. And then I got real very strong experience about when I spent my first nights with the children on the pediatric cancer ward. Mm-hmm. And then this was an experience dealing with these kids with their extreme intensive treatment. Look, you have to imagine a child with leukemia today, its chances of dying due to the treatment are as high as dying due to the tumor. And it was also dealing with these were extremely interesting kids, you know. Kids who lived for half a year under this threat of dying. Look, the treatments they get are awful. And, but, no, it was an experience. And at the same time, I became fascinated with pediatric oncology due to, it was one of the few fields in medicine where really a progress had happened. You have to imagine that in the mid-1960s, if a kid was diagnosed with leukemia, its chances were about 15% of survival, and this improved over a decade to about 70%. And these people who pioneered this sort of treatment of these kids were still around, you know. These were now the people in their mid-40s and very energetic, nice people, you know. And essentially what this experience with the kids led me then to the idea to deal more with it. And first I thought to do a medical thesis in this context, which then afterwards led to that. So that I really did more and more basic research related to these sort of tumors, and which then in the end led to my thesis, yeah, after 6 years later. Yeah.
And well, I guess there's, you know, why were you able to, because it seems to me you can look at it two ways, and you do clinical research in neuroblastomas where the survival rate is incredibly poor.
Right.
So you could look at it, you know, look at it as a glass half full, and in terms of medicine and its ability to help these young children.
Okay.
As opposed to looking at it half empty, which is,
okay,
you know, the survival rate was still fairly horrific.
Okay. Neuroblastoma. Tumors. Look, neuroblastoma is the tumor which hides for me a very ambivalent tumor. If my children would have neuroblastoma, they would not get any treatment. And
Because
the prognosis with neuroblastoma today is the same as 25 years ago. Essentially, all the this modern aggressive chemotherapy did not improve the survival of neuroblastoma at all. And essentially, the way I experienced children with neuroblastoma, now I mean stage 3 and 4, not stage, these kids, modern therapy is only extends pain and suffering. And now, if my kids would have that,
yeah,
morphines and that's it.
Yeah. So where and, were you
okay. Look, okay, the thing, if I think the only way today with kids with neuroblastoma, if people would like to treat it, is would to try out new things which may improve or, the outcome, or which may give new knowledge. But I'm very pessimistic here with neuroblastoma.
Yeah. Okay. And so where were you seeing the role of...
Wait, let's stay with neuroblastoma. Which, let's jump off, because, look, I was doing a lot with neuroblastoma. And what happened was that during my... last year of medical school and the last year I worked on my thesis, there was really a time of big hope for neuroblastoma treatment. What happened was that neuroblastoma is the same... the corresponding adult tumor would be at the pheochromocytoma. And for pheochromocytoma, a drug was found which is enriching in the tumor and with which you can make scintigrams. So with which you can image for is there tumor or not. And at the university hospital where I did my thesis, the clinicians found out that the same drug can be used to image neuroblastoma. And now... what I did then for a year is that I studied how this drug is doing it, and I characterized how neuroblastoma cells take up this drug and which cells take it up, which ones do not take it up. And this then led to the idea, oh, by the way, this drug is today worldwide this... third drug to the most sensitive tool to detect neuroblastoma. So for imaging purposes, it's totally established now. But we had then the hope, coming from the results which I had, which showed that this drug is taken up actively and that you get about 100, 200 times higher doses of this drug inside of the neuroblastoma cell compared to a non-tumor cell. We had this idea that we could use this principle by putting a radioactive emitter or, on this drug, that we eventually could kill the drugs this way. And we tried to do that with neuroblastoma kids. And what happened was that I still remember the first kid which really had a huge metastasis, perhaps the size of a grapefruit. And we gave this kid this now, this injected this radioactive drug, and you really could see how this tumor shrank. You really, so clear-cut, it was able to work on these huge tumors. And then when the kid was retreated, it shrank again. What happened was that it came out that this drug is able to shrink small big tumors, but it's unable of taking care of single cells, which are sitting around in the body. So essentially, this drug did not improve the treatment of the kids at all. And it was a little bit of a disappointment, but look, in my youth, I still had this hope that we could find the cure of for neuroblastoma. Yeah. But look, back to what I said, that I would not treat my kid for neuroblastoma. This is only due to that I do not see anything, according to my knowledge in the moment, which would help. Look, I would have a total different opinion if my kid would have a leukemia.
Right.
We would go for extreme aggressive treatment.
Yeah.
So.
Okay.
So essentially what happened was that then around 1980, I wanted to become a pediatrician. And
how long were you in medical school by this point?
You
had your clerkships.
Medical school in Germany is a little bit different.
Yeah.
What's happening is I started medical school in 86. So 87, 88, I did, 70.
Okay, that's
sorry,
okay.
Sorry. Yeah. It was 76, 77 when I did my preclinical stuff.
Okay.
And so it was 78, 9 when I started to work in the children's hospital during nights. Before that, I made money in other ways. That I became fascinated by these tumor kits, that must have been 79, because already in 1980, I have the first records of working in the lab there. And there must have been some month in between, and yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Well, you had just to kind of clear it up in my mind, based on some experiences, your experiences as a 16, 17, 18-year-old with pacifism and also your civil service job, that you decide that you really want to pursue something that would involve you with humans. And
right.
More personal.
Right. And then what happened when I was in medical school, the ideas dealing with humans as I had it, really, I did not feel anything for that. For example, I did not feel anything doing a clerkship in internal medicine. This was a look, internal medicines are old people. I did not want to deal with old people during that time. I did not connect so much.
Intellectually or spiritually?
No, emotional? No, God, right. Look, I like playing with kids.
Okay.
Until today.
Okay.
Right.
And then, so with your experience in the pediatric oncology ward, how does this lead to, getting focus in terms of whether you're going to spend, focus on or direct your energies towards clinical?
During that time, early 80s, I would have thought that I make a combination out of a clinic and research related to clinic near research. And it was really a time of hope in this sense. Look, what happened was that the hospital I was working at during that time specimens of the kids went down to the basic lab and were checked whether these specimens respond to certain drugs or not. And I was fascinated by this idea. I was fascinated by an idea that we could take bone marrow of a kid and treat it to get rid of the tumor cells and give it back. And I was really more and more fascinated by this interface of clinic with research lab-related, with an interface here in between. And I also was fascinated at that time I came in contact the way that clinical studies were done for these kids. And and during that time, if you would have asked me what would you be, in I think between 80 and 86, I would have told you that it may be that I would end up as an attending on pediatric oncology and would follow that up. And this is also how then the history went, that essentially what happened between 1980 and 86 was that with perhaps 40% of my effort I did politics, with 20% of my effort I did medical school, and with 40% of my other effort I did research related to pediatric oncology. And and this is why I lack a lot of knowledge in medicine, because I never was interested in it, in many things. For example, I do not have a basic knowledge about techniques in surgery. In the surgery clerkship, which we had to do, essentially I did as little as possible. And or sometimes I used my connections with the pediatric hospital not to do stuff, excuses like that I had to do lab experiments which seemed to be important, you know. And due to the, we have to say the following, the pediatric oncologists during that time were extremely powerful in medicine, because they really had changed medicine a little bit. And so these young professors with their 45, in the range they were 43 to 50, they had a lot of influence at the university. And when it became clear that you were connected to these people, you were sometimes home free. And I used that sometimes, you know. Yeah. And then essentially what happened was that it was totally clear that finishing with medical school, they immediately would give me a residency at this place at the university that I...
the Children's Hospital.
Yeah, and that was now normal residency would go that you, at the Children's Hospital, that you would go through a rotation of the different disciplines in pediatrics. You would do, let's say, 6 months general, then you would do 3 months of preemies, then you would do nephrology, and there was, a very stringent plan. But what happened was that instead of doing that, I was officially in pediatric oncology, but spending 80% of my working time doing basic research, which led then to my PhD. And and then the idea was that it was totally clear I would need 2 years of general rotations before I would, in Germany, pediatrics normally would be a 5-year program, and 2 years would be fixed, which where you really have to show you saw so many patients of this, so many of that. And what happened was that my idea was I was fascinated by a new idea of bone marrow transplantation, which during that time seemed to be developed at Sloan Kettering or in at Hutchinson in Seattle. Mm-hmm. And I decided that I first go to the United States for a year to learn this new methodology. And then afterwards, after coming back, finish my residency, yeah, and go on. And this never happened.
Okay. Let me flip the tape over and we'll find out why this never happened.